This is the Dan Le Batard Show with the Stugatz Podcast.
Before we go down this path, and I'm sorry I didn't say a more friendly hello to introduce you here. Billy, can you just tell me how you would describe your relationship with Mina?
I like Mina. I mean, I think we're, you know, acquaintances.
Thank you, Billy, for nothing. Mina, how would you describe your relationship with Billy? Because you attacked him as soon as he arrived. Again, and Billy, you're just exasperating. When I need a lot, you give me a little. And when I need a little, you give me a lot. Like, you're just a perpetual exasperation. Just turn your microphone off. I don't want to talk to you. Mina, how would you describe your relationship with Billy?
I have the perfect analogy. It's like when you have a cat for a really long time and it's been your only pet, and you know, maybe you have a menagerie of other animals, but the point is you only have one cat. That's Billy. He's the cat in this scenario. Dan, you're the owner. Then one day you see another cat walking down the street in an alley, and you think, oh, what a cute little kitten. Cats like each other, right? Despite not having any, you know, research or idea how cats get along. So you bring the new cat home. The way those two cats would interact, and I think most situations based on my knowledge of like cat dynamics, is how Billy and I interact. Not necessarily fighting, nothing overt, nothing aggressive, but not really friends, right? You can't really deduce how they feel about each other. They're just two cats.
Two cats that fight, by the way, because what do you mean no? Mina, when you got here...
Just a couple of cats, Dan, you know.
Mina, when you got into our environment, the place that you decided to attack, you surveyed the environment and you were like, well, I am not an aggressive person and I need to establish something here in the prison yard. I'm going to go after the weakest of the links. That's what it felt like happened here, the most neurotic of the links.
But that was a one-time thing. That was the alley cat coming in, seeing the pampered house cat, and wanting to briefly assert dominance, but then kind of letting it go after a while. And you know what? He stays away from my litter box now. He doesn't mess with me. And I think we've reached an equilibrium.
Okay, well, I think, though, that that's about to be ruined right now, because Mina has an idea, Billy, that would totally ruin the Marlins season. This is an idea she really actually believes in. It's not an idea I've heard. I haven't heard this idea espoused by anybody. Explain to me where you heard it and what it is that you believe has some plausibility here.
So, first of all, I put it in the document of ideas, and the way I described it was, someone told me this. I think it's interesting. I didn't really throw my weight behind it. I want to make that very clear. The person who I heard from, however, is a high-ranking sports person. I won't say what sport, but it's an executive, okay? And we've been talking about what's been going on in baseball, and he suggested to me, and we were talking about the probability that all these postponed games will even happen. And we were talking about the fact that there's this kind of awkward... Not awkward, but you've got the commissioner of baseball basically trying to push the blame onto the players. You've got people asking, well, maybe there should be some personal accountability in all of this, like everything, but, you know, not wanting to completely let the commissioner get off scot-free. So the idea is this. If you're a team, a baseball team, and you have an outbreak, okay, instead of having your game postponed, it should be a loss for you. That way, you're not punished financially. Yeah, I guess if it hurts your chances to get to the playoffs, there's bonuses there, but it's not like a dramatic, oh my God, I'm being held accountable for my, you know, teammates' bad behavior. And it would compel self-regulation, because here's a punishment nobody wants. You know, if you're a team, you want to make it to the playoffs, you want to win games, so you're more likely to tell your teammate, hey man, don't go to that casino. Or if you're the Marlins, do you really need a milk right now? Don't go out for a milk. What do you think?
Billy, so you've been very excited about the way the Marlins have started the season. What are they now? After winning a doubleheader against the Orioles, 5-1.
5-1, Dan. Or, best team in baseball.
Or as Chris Cody says, 13.5 and 2.7 based on the prorated rate of basically 2. Yes, yeah, see, Mina made the face that I made during the local hour, not understanding this math. Chris, why don't you explain it to Mina here so that she understands what the Marlins record is today before we get to Billy's thoughts on Mina saying the Marlins should take losses for getting sick.
Every game in a 60-game season is worth 2.7 games from what it would be in a normal season, Mina. So the Marlins are 5-1. We take the 5. We times it by 2.7. We get 13.5. The Marlins are 13.5 and 2.7 to start the season, and I'm fired up.
I just love the fact that you say times it still as an adult.
He's an adult.
I was explaining it. I'm teaching.
Believe it or not, that went a lot better this time around than last time around.
You should have heard how he tried to explain it during the local hour, but he is a total unmitigated oaf, and that's what he does. He times it. So how do you feel about what it is that Mina's suggesting there, even though she's suggesting a diluted version of it, putting on an unnamed executive that may or may not be from baseball, and also saying that she put it in a document without full weight behind it, as if her full weight behind anything would mean anything. And she did say, I thought this idea was reasonable. She did say that. That is something that sounds like putting a lot of your weight behind it. So, Billy, your thoughts are what here? Because it's not an idiotic thought.
I mean, I'm glad that we're cats that stay in separate litter boxes, because, geez, that took a long time to get to. And, I mean, this probability talk seems boring to me. So you think people should be punished for getting sick? Okay, sorry, Mean. I mean, it seems like the sickness is punishment enough, but I guess we'll give them losses, too.
I'm just suggesting that we're all facing, as a nation, as a world, as a society, but certainly as individual sports, how do you solve this problem of the commons, right? This problem where this disease, you can be a person who does everything right and wears your masks and follows the rules, but if you run into the wrong person on the wrong day and they do the wrong thing, you're screwed. And there's no natural solution for this other than actually, you know, making a bubble and enforcing it with an outside source. So I'm suggesting that perhaps, you know, you could call it even a system of incentives. Think of it this way instead of a system of punishments. If you play by the rules, you got a chance of winning. It's an incentive.
What was that mumbled voice thing that you did there? What were you trying to convey with the muttering?
It's the bubble, right? I mean, obviously, they should have had a bubble. I mean, that's the whole sort of problem with all of this and every non-bubble sport. I just, like, didn't feel like relitigating that for the 10,000th time.
Dan hated the bubble idea for baseball. It was so strange. But what do you do if you're, like, one of these people that gets it, that's following the rules, and someone that's a rule breaker gives it to you? Now you just lose because you had bad luck?
First of all, you're not losing the whole season. It's probably, how many games did the Marlins miss that are now losses?
I mean,
three or four, five.
Okay.
No, they missed like a week, but by Chris's math, it's like 17 games.
Let me apply it to this situation, maybe draw an analogy. What if you guys knew if one of you caught it, there would be no show for the day? Wouldn't you be more likely to, if let's say you're Billy and you see a picture of Chris, he's tagged on Instagram, he's at a bachelor party with his boys out fishing, just not wearing a mask. Wouldn't you be more likely to text him? He's making like bro faces right now and say, hey, man, I don't know how you guys talk to each other, but sup, bro, why are you doing that? That was a question for you, Billy. That was a serious question. If there was a system of, you know, a punitive system in play, wouldn't you be more likely to self-regulate?
I would. I actually don't think this is a crazy idea. I don't think like the first time you get sick, you should be just get losses. But if it becomes like a repetitive thing, like maybe 7 games, you can have 7 postponed games because of this. But once you get past that, they're all losses. Like if this happens again to the Marlins, they all just start becoming losses. I'm with that. I don't think you should just start at losses, but there should be a threshold maybe.
Mullah games.
All right. Excellent work out of you, Billy, as always. Mina Kimes will accuse me of rooting against sports in the next segment. But here is the fake Stugatz. Billy, you were a special kind of terrible in that segment.
Thanks, Dano.
Mina, why is your head in your hands? Chris, why are you so frustrated? Start with Mina. We got to get to Bomani Jones here.
Do we have time? I mean, that had to have been half of the segment right there.
Yeah, it took a long time. It really did.
Somehow but somehow they've approximated the like tone, tenor, and length of a normal Billy story.
Yes.
And you didn't even write it.
I know. It's amazing. So anyways, Bomani Jones is doing a lot of interesting things right now. The latest with Vanity Fair is something I want to get into. But as it relates to this college football stuff, he's actually been reporting and talking to players. So I wanted to understand what's happening with college football, because it actually feels like we might actually find some systemic change from within this as players have discovered that they actually have a power. It took a pandemic. So first, Bomani, thank you for joining us. Check out his podcast, The Right Time with Bomani Jones. Can you tell us what it is specifically you did for Vanity Fair?
Actually, I can't.
Okay. Very good.
I can just tell you that I can tell you that it's really good and it's kind of long, but they want to wait for the issue and all the stuff to actually come out. But I can tell you generally, it is an issue that is guest edited by Ta-Nehisi Coates. You got some other people in there. Ava DuVernay is doing something. I know Josie Duffy Rice is doing something for it. It's going to be pretty damn dope. And my story has a really cool picture on it. I know that much.
Mm. Bo, I want to ask you sort of from a macro level about what's happening right now with college athletes, because it's sort of both a product of forces that have been building for a long time, but also of this particular moment, right? A moment in which the quote-unquote benefits that have been portrayed as pay, erroneously, for a lot of these kids are not necessarily available to them when there's no central authority making decisions that would protect their health. And then, of course, there's this broader background of this movement for racial and social justice that clearly is informing a lot of this. Now, those other things, well, they're going to go back to normal once this is all over. So do you think this movement by these athletes is sustainable beyond the pandemic?
Well, it's interesting because I think that what's going on in the Pac-12 and what's going on in the Big Ten are two different things. I talked to a gentleman with the Big Ten movement yesterday. And the difference between their movement and the Pac-12 movement, aside from the fact that the Big Ten movement is not asking for compensation and the Pac-12 movement is, it's the fact that the Big Ten movement views itself as working cooperatively with its conference. And the Pac-12 guys are struggling to get, you know, Larry Scott and those people to actually meet with them with any sort of urgency. That's a huge one there. Like, what I think there's a potential for in the Big Ten is they might be able to establish some sort of cooperative relationship with the conference, because I think that at the very least, the Big Ten seems to understand that the goals of this movement, at least in the short run, are actually the same as the goals of the conference, which is to make sure that they actually play. This is going to require a more stringent enforcement of the safety protocols. The problem I think that the Big Ten guys are ultimately going to learn is that these guys have no interest in cooperating with you. That's not really what they want to do. I think they want to do it right now in order to get everybody back onto the field. But in a larger sense, if the schools had any interest in cooperating with the players, they would have done it by now. Andrew Cooper, who is a distance runner at Cal, who has been on these issues for a very, very long time, but he said a big thing that he's learned in all his study is that you can only start a labor movement with a work stoppage. And so that, I think, is a big distinction between the two of them. And when we start talking about what the sustainability of this can be, it really depends on whether the Pac-12 is going to be willing to take these guys seriously and whether the Big Ten is going to show respect for that cooperation.
It's interesting, Bo, because I keep hearing from people who know better than I that the whole college football thing is going to collapse here within like 10 days, that we're about to approach some sort of Armageddon on this. And I wonder, you may have just answered this, I wonder if the things that we see happening now die right there. Die with their inability to take the games away from colleges.
Well, I mean, they can take them away, right? It just depends on how much heart people have in this. If they want to do it, they can take it away. It's really going to be a matter of how far a lot of these players are willing to go. When they walk this up to the line, how far is it that they are willing to go? There are some that are absolutely willing to say, no, I'm not going to play. There were some that couldn't even get past 24 hours of the letter being out because the power dynamics are so skewed, and guys just have to say to themselves, I guess this is just the thing that we have to do. But the thing that COVID's going to flip on this is, even if it doesn't look like a real outward revolutionary sort of, fine, I'm not going to play, a lot of these guys are just simply going to opt out because they're terrified. Like, before we even get to, like, the seismic change or what could happen to the larger landscape of college football, there's a very human element of this, I think, that everybody needs to deal with, which is the fact that these dudes are scared and don't really have much power over what they can do in terms of actually playing and having to subject themselves to the risks that come from COVID-19. The next level of it that I don't think gets discussed nearly enough is these guys aren't just doing this for themselves. They're doing this for their coaches. Most of the guys that I've talked to in the Pac-12 said that when they talk to their coaches, their coaches were on board with what they were doing, in large part because the coaches also think that this is a futile mission and that the guys aren't being protected. And on that list of coaches who feels that way, by the way, was Nick Rolovich at Wazoo. Like, I don't know what happened and what flipped at the end, but players told me that they talked to him a couple weeks before this, and they talked to him about the movement, and that he was supportive of it because he understood that what was going on was not sustainable. And then at the end, he went and lost his mind. So, I mean, for a lot more people than I think that people, than folks understand they are.
Yeah, it's interesting, Bo, because the coaches are, from a health and safety perspective, like the most vulnerable people in some ways now because of their age, right? You've got your like James Franklin's having to spend the entire season coaching away from his family. He's not the only one. The difference, of course, is that they're being compensated, which makes it an entirely different equation. But part of me wonders if the NCAA had gotten its, you know what, together back in June and there was a centralized, you know, authority in all of this and there were some guidelines in a sense that there was a teacher in the room, that maybe we wouldn't have even gotten to this point.
Yeah, but I think that part of what creates such an issue here for the NCAA, and I just don't think this gets talked enough, which is we talk a lot about there being like the Power Five and then the Group of Five of all this, but the reality is the distinction of the football bowl subdivision is too broad. It's kind of like how in the franchise tag in the NFL they call all its offensive linemen the same, and it messes up the scale there because there's a difference between what a center gets paid, what a guard gets paid, what a tackle gets paid. I think a major problem the NCAA has here, if I want to cut them a little bit of slack here, is testing is expensive, and not everybody can afford to do these tests. And even if we looked at the NCAA and said, well, why don't you guys pay for the testing? And 95% of their budget comes from that tournament that they did not have in March and April. So even if they wanted to have these standardized protocols, the problem with standardizing it is not everybody can afford what the standard is going to be. Now, I don't know this for a fact, but this has been my assumption, is that the Ivy League went ahead and made their call and said, hey, we're not going to have a season. The next two conferences to say they weren't going to have one were the SWAC and the MEAC. And as much as I would like to think that my HBCUs were out in front of this issue and standing on behalf of the players, I also know damn well they could not afford the level of testing that would be required in order for this to happen. And a lot of schools cannot afford the level of testing that is required in order for this to happen. So I do think that as much as the NCAA would love to have had something standard, I don't know how they can when not everybody can afford this. And I do think that at some point when people start scratching beneath the surface, what they're going to find in this is a lot of schools have been going about this the wrong way simply so they don't have to pay for all these tests.
I have more questions. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is where you should get your insight on matters like these. We come back with Bomani Jones in a second. Bomani Jones with us, The Right Time with Bomani Jones. I got a million questions and no time to ask them. Among the details, Colorado State, Washington State, Clemson, Florida State, being reported about how these coaches deal with these college players, which are the ones that you find most dehumanizing?
The one that jumps out to me is Washington State, and not exactly, I think, for the reasons that people would think. I don't know if this has been like really publicly reported, but a big thing that happened after the guys opted out was that they then received an email from the athletic director that stated the things they would still have access to, counseling, academic support, things like that. The things they would no longer have access to, it was two big things. One of them was the weight room and the locker room, and the other one was the dining halls. And both of those I actually think to be reasonable, that if you're saying your concern is for COVID, then we need to decrease the number of people that are coming through here. And totally understand that. The thing was, how are they supposed to eat if they can't come to the dining hall became the question. And so I had talked to two players who had specifically said that after Sunday, they had not eaten because they did not have access to meals. So I hit up Washington State Sports Information Director and I asked, so what are players going to do for meals? And he said, well, they will have an increase in their stipend check. Okay, got it. Next stipend check, I asked one player, he said he expects to get his stipend check on August the 20th. Here's what I find dehumanizing about that. They told me that, but as far as I can tell, they did not tell the players that. That in the course of all of this, nobody seemed to stop and ask themselves, well, damn, how are these dudes going to eat? No one seemed to ask that. I asked one player, I was like, are you doing okay on food? And he said, yeah, I had a job and I was able to save up some money, so I'm good. But that's not dealing with getting your food in the short run. So we'll see when that next run of checks comes out whether these guys get the money. I imagine that they would, but what are they supposed to do in the intervening time period? It blows my mind that nobody would consider that fact.
Bo, not a lot of time left. But I want to ask you, you've been talking to some of these kids. Are they different from how we were, because it occurs to me when we talk about whether all this is sustainable, this current moment will pass, things will go back to normal in college sports, but it seems like it's plausible there's an underlying shift in the way these student athletes see their situation and see the world in general.
Yeah, I think that we're dealing with a much more idealistic set of young people. I think we've seen this across the board. And the point that I've made in the last couple of months is that, generally speaking, this generation of people don't make enough money to expect to get their piece of the rock down the line. I think the people my age believe that that was the way that it would spin, that we've reached a point where we would get our piece of the rock. They don't think they're going to get their piece of the rock. Therefore, they demand that these companies that they deal with, they demand that these companies come strong for them. They demand that these companies represent what they claim to represent. And that, I think, is the biggest difference.
Bomani, thank you. Check out his work at The Undefeated. He has been reporting this story. And check out his work, The Right Time with Bomani Jones is the podcast. Thank you for being on with us, Bo. We appreciate it.
All right. Check out First Take at 11. I'm about to jump on there, too.
All right. First Take at 11 as well. I'm wondering here, Mina, because something Bomani just tweeted out I want to talk to you about, which is the things that are happening here on The Ellen Show. And now Jay Leno has come to the total unequivocal defense of Ellen. And one of the things Bomani says, it's best for to ride for your folks in private on these kinds of things, especially with a person with enough money to ride for themselves in public. So I want to talk Ellen with Mina next. Your fake Stugatz is actively giving Mina Kimes a headache. Mina Kimes is sitting in with us today. And I want to put on the poll, Guillermo, please, at Lebatard Show. Do you, the person answering this poll, do you say I couldn't care less or I could care less? Because LeBron James says I could care less that Donald Trump doesn't want to watch our games because he calls kneeling a disgrace. And so I'm asking the audience, because so many, LeBron got that phrase wrong. You don't say I could care less. The phrase is I couldn't care less, but I feel like a lot of people say I could care less. I'll get to that with Mina Kimes in a second, because I think this Axios interview that Trump did is the single worst interview I've ever seen from an American president. Like, you can't even make it up. It was hypnotizing, breathtaking, just amazing to watch. You will never get another interview like that in the future with a president, and you certainly don't have one in the past. But before we get to that, I wanted to get to the story we were talking about regarding Ellen. Now, Ellen has always had this pristine reputation as just being a wonderfully kind woman that people like, that's the reason she's popular and her TV show does so well, because people like her. And now her workplace is evidently filled with hostility and sexual harassment. People have been fired. She says she doesn't know anything about that. And Jay Leno is putting out on Twitter, I don't discard a 40-year friendship on hearsay. The Ellen I know has raised over $125 million for charity and has always been a kind and decent person. I fully support her. And then he signs it on Twitter, Jay Leno, which is the true sign of an old person when it's coming from the Jay Leno verified account and he is signing it to Jay Leno. But Bomani is saying, do that in private. You don't need to be riding publicly for people when you don't know the details on what their workplace environment was.
Yeah, no one's asking you to discard your 40-year friendship. They're just asking you to say nothing, dude. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he can still be her friend. Like, all these famous people writing for her, by the way, it kind of has the opposite effect, right? Because I kind of believe them all when they say that she's nice to them. But breaking news, a lot of famous and successful and rich and influential people are only nice to other famous, rich, successful, and influential people. Like, that's not in dispute. It seems to me that the people coming forward are like underlings and, you know, lower level folks.
I was jarred by it, though, because her public reputation is one that is so pristine. Like, that show pays her $50 million a year, I feel like, and she's a good comedian. Other comedians in that small world of comedians will tell you she is good at stand-up comedy, good at the sculpted skills of comedy, but I believe that success of that show has almost everything to do with she's publicly likable. Right. People just like her. And so the disconnect for me between her pristine reputation publicly and the people working for her saying, man, we had a terrible environment and people have been fired now, Mina. Executive producers have been fired. And you know what's happening now in America where all of this stuff ends up getting politicized. So when the woke people or the gay people or the minorities take these hits about sexual harassment in the workplace, when it's Ellen, you know that that gets weaponized by the other side to sort of laugh at, see what happens when all of you are liberal? You know, it happens all the time. Like, it happened to me this week. It happened to me this week with a stupid poll that we did. Like, people delight in sort of the appearance of hypocrisy. Oh, look, they're one of the woke people getting caught by the fragile Me Too stuff and the sensitive stuff.
I find that really frustrating, what the phenomena you're referring to, the sort of whataboutism, right, where any issue or mistake or topic gets weaponized in this constant culture war that we're all caught into, because sometimes I wish we could just talk about the underlying issue itself. I felt this way about DeSean Jackson. I've often felt this way about the NBA in China when I came out and talked to you about that the other day, where like these are issues and stories and screw-ups by athletes and people in sports and leagues that very much deserve to be discussed. The NBA, for example, deserves criticism. But then you go on the internet and you see, oh wait, this actual discussion has been like run through a funhouse mirror and refracted and distorted and used to have this separate argument about Black Lives Matter. I don't want to have that argument, and I don't want to support someone using it in bad faith, but I feel like we can't let those people dictate the bounds of discussion and say, okay, we can't talk about China or DeSean Jackson or whatever.
Can you help me understand because the way that we're divided in this country right now, and everyone's in their own bubbles, and what your echo chamber of Twitter or the people who follow you, they're much different than the people attack you when one of these things ends up getting weaponized. But I'm watching, and I know that my leanings, my sensibilities align with John Oliver's, but I'm marveling, okay, at what they continue to do on television, the degree of difficulty on what he's doing, sort of following John Stewart and all those writers. John Stewart became basically our most credible newsman at the time of Anchorman News, because through comedy, people were enjoying the fact-based reporting and the smart of his show. John Oliver had a segment last week, and it was like 37 minutes of just him talking to a camera. And I cannot tell you, like, Mina and I do television. I'm okay at television. Mina is good at television, but I really just think I'm okay at television. And fine. I know how hard that is, what John Oliver is doing, especially without anyone laughing and just making joke after joke and hard point after hard point. And I know he's got writers, but what I saw him do last week on the subject of how American history has been whitewashed, I don't see, while watching that, as I get fact after fact after fact, how people can take sides on that, because he's just giving facts and facts. But because people are aligned in their camps now, and because that's not what you're getting on that whatever John Oliver is giving you is not what you're getting in your bubble. What are you laughing about?
Billy just wrote in the chat, why does John Oliver get praise when his stories go on for 35 minutes, but I get crushed?
Because you deserve it, dude.
It's a valid point, Billy. He's exactly like you. If your stories were cogent, useful, relevant, had a point, were going somewhere, researched perhaps, then yeah, you're the same.
Thank you.
So you think your 35 minutes are comparable to John Oliver sitting in front of a camera with his writers working all week for that half hour of television? Yeah. You think your yammering ramblings are in that company of John Oliver?
I have a theory, and this cuts to what you were saying at the very top of the show about Billy, which is, if you want nothing from him, he'll give you 35 minutes. If we said, hey, Billy, you're going to get 35 minutes on the radio to say whatever you put together, a John Oliver-esque presentation about, reality TV or whatever you're interested in, he would give you 30 seconds and then tap out.
You're overestimating him. He would fart and then collapse in a puddle of his own neuroses.
Show me the money.
30 seconds. I'm dying to get 30 seconds of good out of him. one of these times. One of these times, an efficient 30 seconds of good when I need just 30 seconds. But Billy and I have never, I'm saying this in the history of our show, never once had our timing down. Never once.
Guests on the Dan Le Batard Show appear via the Shell Pennzoil performance line. It's that time of year. The NFL is almost here and ESPN Fantasy Football is around the corner. Listen, man, I didn't ask for any of this. Draft your team, compete with your friends, and take home the crown. Sign up now at ESPN.com/fantasyfootball today. Dano, now your sports center update. Fall sports championships have been canceled in NCAA Division II and Division III as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. Max Scherzer exited because of the leg issue after laboring through one inning in the Mets' 3-1 victory over Washington. And finally, the average person will spend 90,000 hours at work in their lifetime. Not me. For all the latest headlines and information, tune in to SportsCenter on ESPN Radio all throughout the day.
So just out of curiosity, Billy, as a producer for this radio show, were you trying to put Mina in a position to fail there, or did it just happen by accident?
Whoa! I thought I crushed it.
Yeah. She said it, you know, in one of the breaks, she said, you know, I think I could do a better Stugatz than you did. I said, why don't you interrupt the next SportsCenter? And then she said, why don't I do the next SportsCenter? I said, sure. Go right ahead.
I'm sure someone at home listening thought that was Stugatz.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would know, based on the impressions today, anyone would know Stugatz was off today.
The reason I asked the question, Billy, is because I know you to be a creature who is haunted by fears and neuroses. I don't think of you as a creature that is filled with joy, but the greatest happiness I ever see on your face is the happiness I saw about 2 seconds into her reading when you were enjoying someone other than you failing. Mina, I'm telling you, he looked so happy. What he does is, look, we're doing this on Zoom right now. This is when I know that Billy the Instigator has achieved his success of throwing a Molotov cocktail in the middle of our show. He pushes his chair back. Does that chair have wheels? And he leans against the wall behind him, sort of scared, but red-faced with laughter because someone other than him is failing. And that's what I just saw. Chris, tell me I'm wrong on this, because you've seen it before. Billy does it to you more than anyone, where he specifically puts you in positions to fall on your face and then roars with laughter at playing defense against everyone's career.
Oh, he loves it. He loves when people fail. It's kind of a thing on this show. I find myself doing it too. When somebody else is failing, I'm just like, good, they get it for once. Like, we've created this atmosphere where it's just like, we all want to do a good show, but we all want each other to fail miserably.
Bunch of Ellens, it sounds like, around here, guys. I wanted Mina to succeed. I thought she did a great job. She was doing something out of her comfort zone that she enjoyed. I was happy. I was happy for her.
Not a bunch of Ellens. One Ellen, because, you know, the fish rots from the bespectacled head. You guys know what I'm talking about.
Jesus. Wow. Christ, she just hit me with a bespectacled head fish reference that was directed at me. She just called me Ellen because she tried to do the worst Stugatz I've heard since Jerry O'Connell yesterday on
You're trying to turn the cats against each other, and you know what? Cats don't fight like that. At least they don't fight at the behest of humans. As far as I understand cat behavior, that's not how it works. There's no cat.
Cats eat fish, Dan.
Thank you, Billy, for nothing, as always. Yeah, thank you for kidding around. Can you guys help me, please, understand why I have the reputation that I do with the audience and with you, where Mina, you think that I'm rooting against sports? Like, I honestly really don't understand why anyone would get that impression of me.
Yet again, I didn't say Dan Le Batard is rooting at sports. Like a great producer wanting to, you know, foment some spirited discussion on the show, I wrote in all caps, is Dan Le Batard rooting against sports? So you are heavily presuming how I feel about it before we even get this started. All I'm saying, Dan, is yesterday on Highly Questionable, we joked about a movie called False Positive, and I said your movie would be called True Negative, right? It's tonal. Like, I think right now, there's this whole, if you're realistic about COVID, your quote-unquote rooting against sports thing that's going around the internet. That's obviously absurd. However, I think some people are picking up on tone, and this is more about the internet than the radio, although I don't know what your fans are saying, where there's a sense of, like, doom, correctly, right, if you're talking about the facts, that can sometimes hang over these conversations.
So it's doom in the face of hope? Is that what we're talking about? Get you accused of rooting against sports? Like, it's, as opposed to hoping, which is what we've been doing with our masks off, as we continue to be the worst in the world at this pandemic. Like, the worst in the world. We are worse than anybody by leaps and bounds, and we had plenty of warning that this was coming. That's rooting against sports because I've been hiding in my house for 6 months.
This goes back to the tone situation Mina was just bringing up a second ago. See, not the best there.
I think it kind of cuts actually to what we were talking earlier about how everybody goes on the internet or wherever these days wanting to have a fight and then seeing whatever's happening in the landscape and then taking that information and fitting it into the rubric of the fight people want to have, right? Which is how you end up with situations where reporters are literally just putting out factual information about the pandemic and, you know, science, what they're seeing, what they're reading, what they're hearing, and perhaps being critical of the leagues. And then it gets filtered through this argument that people want to have where you're rooting against sports, which obviously you're not doing. Obviously, none of us are because all of our livelihoods depend on it.
Okay, so in that vein, though, because social media is such a poison well, and I saw Michelle Obama on her new podcast saying that she's just got a low-level depression that soaks her, and it spoke to me because I've been feeling it lately just by what is happening in our streets and on social media. And I ask you, Mina, as a young person and the relationship with social media, I have gotten such relief from getting out of my phone. I can't entirely, because if you do, you fall behind, and you can't fall behind in the sports talking business. But if I could throw my phone into the ocean and never touch it again, I would be in a more peaceful, emotional, spiritual, mental place than if I were checking social media and finding everyone fighting about this garbage, this just perpetual poison well garbage. And I'm wondering what your relationship is with social media, as someone who has to be on top of things, August 17th, when you start on NFL Live and you have to know everything that's happening with football, but you're always entering just a contaminated space where everyone is fighting with each other.
I've gotten better at looking less, which it bums me out, though, because there are still people saying nice and funny things, fans of your show with inside jokes, like interesting and cool conversations happening, but you can't read everything or you're going to see the toxic stuff as well. And the only thing you can do to protect your own mental health is set up a filtration system of sorts, right? I would say it's funny. When I first started doing your radio show, I was thinking about this, right? Because it's been a long time. I was really struggling with this. You remember I would come on and tell you that I was crying reading social media, not just from doing the radio show, but from going on Highly Questionable and learning that there were things wrong with me that I never knew. I never knew I had a, you know, messed up nose and a weird laugh and skinny Brandon Ingram arms until the internet told me so. And it used to be really devastating. But I've actually gotten a lot better at compartmentalizing that over the years. And I don't know how it happened other than I just look less.
That's interesting because I want to get to some sound that John Amici, he broke down privilege so exceptionally well, articulated it. Why are you laughing?
Chris just texted. I didn't know. Chris, can you read it?
No, wait. Hold on a second. No, Chris, you don't read it. No. Hold on. There's in the chat. This is always my favorite. When Mina loses it and can't say something because she's too busy laughing. Yes, it is a funny comment that Chris just made in the chat, but I don't believe that Mina's going to be able to deliver it to the audience because she starts laughing every time. There is a funny joke here to end this segment with. Mina, the floor is yours. No, what did Chris say in the chat? Articulate it clearly. Do not snort. Say it in a way America understands, please, so we can have the ending to this segment without you falling apart.
Chris said, I didn't know I was fat until the internet told me.
Raindrop, drop top, time to read the script for a hot spot.
Chris, you didn't know you were fat until the internet told you?
honestly, I always thought I was just a little, like, you know, just a little so, little extra. But the people, I'm fat, man. It's a thing now. I know it.
You're not fat.
Yes, he is.
Thank you, Mina.
I never had looked at my eyebrows before the internet did. But I want to play this sound. I want to play this sound.
Look in the mirror?
Not really. Not there. I mean, put it on the poll, Guillermo, at Levitard Show. Do you spend any time looking at your eyebrows? At Levitard Show. Just yes or no question. But I want to get into this privilege conversation because specifically you and Sarah and Katie, by coming in here and doing these shows, have taught me something that I would have never had access to if not seeing the lengths you guys have to go to so that the internet won't be cruel to you, because the male demographic that populates this particular cesspool can be awfully cruel and make me wonder sometimes whether they love women or whether they hate women. So I want to get into that with you, but we'll do so next. DraftKings is first here. Tell the people, Fake Stugatz, how they can make some money betting on sports. I want to get to why it is that Mina's Zoom box here is Mrs. Unlimited. I want to get into that. But before we get into that, I want to understand, because our radio show is produced weirdly. And when I say it's produced weirdly, this is what I mean. I just walked into this room to start a segment, and Roy said to me, "Dan, we have a segment." And no one else has given me any information. So no one has said anything to me. That's how this show is produced. Dan, we have a segment. I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. I don't know who I'm supposed to throw it to. Nobody has told me anything.
Allow me, Dan. Take it away, Mina.
All right. I got this. Chris, explain the segment.
All right. Way to go. Here we go.
Okay.
Here
no,
we go.
I got this, Dan.
No.
Right,
I want to hear it from Mina. I want Mina to get it out. I want Mina to explain to me what this segment is. You saw how Billy threw that fish in her lap. You saw that, right? Like, Billy doesn't want to explain
me.
It.
Me.
Yeah. All right. Yes, because you want the segment to fail. You're starting with
that. No. I'm a co-author on this segment. Me and Mina wrote this segment together, I think. I'll take it from here, because Mina seems to need to compose herself for a moment. It's a really good segment, Dan. So basically, the segment started because Chris said that Mike's dog is ugly. So then we were trying to figure out what kind of dogs are attractive dogs and what kind of dogs we don't like. And we said all dogs are cute, and Chris said no. So then we started assigning whose dog, like who would be which breed of dog. So that's the segment. We're each going to assign someone else what kind of dog they are.
And then I called myself, because I feel like I have a jolly attitude, a golden retriever, at which point Mina mocked me, saying I'm way too dumb to be a golden retriever.
That is not what I said. First of all, I claim no authorship over this segment. I want to make
great.
That very clear.
Well, that's good on the so front end. Go ahead.
Here's what really happened. After, you know, slandering Mike's dog, Chris compared himself to a golden retriever, and all of us scoffed. All of us made, like, really faces. And the best analogy I can come up with, it's like when you remember when everyone had those Bitmojis for themselves, and somebody would make a Bitmoji that was way too like very.
Oh, funny. So this is about my looks? Okay,
no.
That's what this is about.
No.
Was brains.
It's just the golden retriever is the alpha of dogs. Okay, that's all. That's all.
It's like a lead in a movie. It's like the main character.
Yes.
Like I need to be like the friend dog, like the funny fat guy.
There are no golden retrievers on this show. I want to be very clear about that.
I could see Chris as like a border collie.
The smartest dog?
Oh, no, never mind.
Dan, the actual origination of the segment was I came in and said, if the Dan Le Batard Show was turned into an animation with dogs as the main characters, what would we all be? To which I assigned Chris a bulldog, an English bulldog, because I think that's what he would be. And that's where everything kind of went off the rails when he called himself the golden retriever.
I found Chris. He's a chow chow. Look up a chow chow, guys. Chris is a chow chow.
Hold on a second. Isn't he a St. Bernard where he's just got the beer right around his collar in a keg? Like, isn't Chris obviously a St. Bernard?
He's a mastiff. That's what he is.
Dan, that's you. Also, you're clearly the St. Bernard.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Okay, how is the St. Bernard in terms of intelligence? Is it an oaf?
Super smart. No, Have you not seen Beethoven? It plays the piano. Did that happen in Beethoven?
I think that's another Beethoven.
In any case, yeah, they're smart. Remember, they wear those little red things around their neck to save people's lives?
The keg of beer that I was previously mentioning there? Yeah, that's right. Okay, so where's the segment?
Well, now we have to go around the room. So, Dan, you can choose someone to assign a dog type to if you'd like. Or you could pass and we'll come back to you at the end. Those are the rules.
Okay, I'll go Mina and Teacup Maltese.
Wow.
I'm going to go Billy here. I'm going to grab Billy here. I'm going to say Billy is a beagle.
It's not your turn. Follow the rules.
What are the rules?
Oh, it's either your turn or you pass it and then it comes back to you. So when you assign a dog a name to someone, so now it's Mina's turn to assign a dog to someone else, and then that person assigns a dog to someone else.
Yeah. I'm sorry for not understanding the rules because you guys produced this segment so well on the front end.
The rules for the show are much more complicated than the actual discussion, and I don't understand them. You're inventing them on the fly. I'm going to go Roy, I suppose, and Pug.
A pug?
What's wrong with a pug?
Pugs are cute.
What's wrong with a pug?
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Look at you went from insulted to charmed. You went from insulted to delighted. All right, who are you going to take out on the dog front? And I'm going to go ahead and put it on the record just so that everyone knows. This was not a good segment idea.
Billy, you are a beagle.
All right.
Chris just said that. Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to say Chris is a Dalmatian, even though I already called him a Chow Chow.
Okay, and I'm going to say Tony. Man, Tony's tough. He's really bougie. What's the bougiest dog? I'm going to go an Afghan hound.
Wow.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, yeah. Is it back to me, or is it with...
I don't know. How does this segment work? As soon as one of you guys wants
I think
to produce
it's a snake
it for
draft.
Me, I'd appreciate it.
All right. If it's back to me, I'm going to say, when you think about it, Amici's right. Privilege really does... hit us all in different ways, and often in ways you don't even think about, right? Like I mentioned earlier that people have given me crap on the internet for, you know, having skinny arms, but those skinny arms give me privilege on like an airplane, right? Because people love to sit next to me on an airplane, so it's all context dependent, and some of us have it more than others. Wouldn't you agree, Dan?
Who is a dog that has skinny arms? Which is the dog that, is it a Doberman? Like where you think of a dog with skinny... skinny, long legs, or a greyhound, probably, right? A greyhound would be, Mina did something fairly extraordinary, getting back to what John Amici was talking about, privilege, and you just don't understand the unholy world that women have to live in this sports bubble, because they give opinions on stuff, and people just tear them apart in every way. It's unspeakably cruel, and I'd never seen it the way that I have seen it with you guys. And Mina, you're likable. Like you have a huge, but you have a Q rating that's very popular. The idea that you would be reduced to tears, the idea that people on the internet and people watching ESPN television would root against you so cruelly and so viciously to make you dissolve when you are among the most popular among us. Like, it's just crazy to me. And the other day, I thought it was brave that you decided to just whip off whatever it is that the coat was you were wearing and show your skinny arms on television for everyone to make fun of and describe them as Brandon Ingram arms.
Yeah, I've stopped wearing sleeveless shirts on television because I get too much crap for... my arms. And then I think Bomani actually said, I actually enjoyed this because Bomani had the same thing. He said he's only recently worked up the courage to do it. And I thought that was really important because, yeah, women, we get it in unusual ways, often worse, but we all get it, man. You don't have to be on television. Like, we have all willingly, as a society, agreed to a social contract where we go on the internet every day and get told terrible things, and we've just decided that that's okay. Every single person in this Zoom chat has seen awful things said about them, right? It's crazy that we've all just agreed to go along with that.
It's crazy that that is the world's greatest addiction. Like there, yeah. I don't even know how to go about sort of exploring how addicted we are to these devices and these connections, but we are addicted to something that in that regard is deeply unhealthy.
I'm going to change my vote and say English Mastiff for you, though. now that I've really had time to think about it.
Good. No elaboration. You're just going to make me an English Mastiff, and that's the segment, guys. No elaboration or why. Just this is the dog that you are. I salute you guys for promising me at the top of this segment we have a segment and failing yet again to deliver in true Baron Davis style.
Thank you, Dan.
All right, so this is what we have going on around here. We have 45 minutes to see if Carrot Top calls to explain himself on why he wasn't at my wedding. 45 minutes because we are now doing a post-game show after our normal show. We've got a bunch of different stuff happening beginning August 17th around here. But one of the things that's happening is this August 17th that you begin NFL Live, Mina, at 4 o'clock, 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock. I cannot wait to watch you dismantle Keyshawn Johnson in a football argument. When is that going to start?
It does start August 17th, but here's the thing, and I kind of love this. You won't see me arguing with Keyshawn or debating or discussing because we are on different days, which means that I am the Keyshawn Johnson of my days. Like, if you had told me at any point, young Mina Kimes, or even 3 years ago, you know, and a very trepid, timid, meek Mina Kimes coming into the Dan Le Batard studio for the first time, that at some point, Keyshawn Johnson and you are going to be viewed as sort of stand-ins for the same role on an NFL show, I would have laughed. And that is exactly what's happened.
Well, here's the thing about your evolution that's been fascinating. You described yourself as meek and whatever other things you just did there, and someone who was, you know, hurt by the way the internet treated you, and you've gone from that to you lean into it by slandering Bruce Springsteen on Twitter and saying okay, there are a thousand acts better than Bruce Springsteen. All of a sudden, you have gone from someone who didn't want to get out there with opinions to willing to desecrate opinions that are going to be very unpopular.
The boss.
Tom Brady. That's the golden retriever. I just thought of it. He is the embodiment of a golden retriever.
That's
like,
good.
If a golden retriever was a human being, it would be Tom Brady.
I get now why you laughed at me being a golden retriever.
Thank you. I wasn't trying to insult you. You know, none of us are golden retrievers. It's just Tom Brady's the one true golden retriever.
Did you not want to talk about Bruce Springsteen? Did you retract that take? Is that something that became too flammable and everybody started yelling at you?
I was kind of trolling. He's fine. The sports writers have a weird obsession and affinity for him. I guess men of a certain age as well. He's fine. It's just not to my taste. But yeah, I was kind of trolling on the internet when I posted that.
How many bands did you put in front of Bruce Springsteen as being better than Bruce Springsteen?
Well, as many as I could fit in 280 characters. So, you know, I would have put more if I could.
Where are you with where the Patriots are right now? Because we have talked precious little with you football. And if you want more football from Mina Kimes, again, NFL Live, 4 to 5 p.m. beginning August 17th. And on her podcast, she does an exceptional job of mixing the information with the interesting and the funny. You could check that out. Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny. The Patriots have a whole lot of people opting out more than any other team. So what? What's going to happen? Does Cam? We'd be done with them if Cam wasn't there, right? We would say, okay, they're not going to win that division now.
I now am very dubious of whether they can win the division for reasons I'll get to. Although, and right now it is 12:36 Eastern, so the NFL opt-out date I believe is at 4. Tre'Davious White, the star cornerback for the Bills, who I believe would be the best player to opt out if he does, it's been rumored that he's considering it. You guys can check to see if that news is broken. But that would be a major opt-out if that happens and sort of affect the balance of the division. But when Cam signed with New England, Dan, my enthusiasm for watching that team was renewed in a big way. I wanted to see what he looked like in that offense. I was pretty high on them. I had them winning the division. But since then, as you mentioned, they've had a lot of players kind of... It really feels like the opening to The Leftovers, right, on the Patriots. Love to talk about a television show that only
I
have watched.
Mina, nobody has watched The Leftovers.
It's so good. People should watch The Leftovers.
They should. It's great. But they're not going to understand the analogy. Going to be doing on NFL Live? Because if you want to lose the entire audience, talk about The Leftovers on NFL Live.
I want to make reference to The Leftovers so often, and I can't because it never achieved mainstream success, and it drives me crazy. But yeah, they've lost a lot of players, but they've also lost meaningful players. Like, they already lost a ton of talent on their defense. And then you lose Dante Hightower, who's sort of the skeleton key to that defense. He's the quarterback of the defense, right? He's the guy with the green dot on his helmet. And you kind of need him to run a very complicated front seven that Bill Belichick does, and Patrick Chung. And suddenly these players start adding up, and you're dependent on rookies. And even with the same coaches at the helm, it starts to get more and more dodgy, to the point where I don't think now they should be the favorites to win the division.
The Leftovers was an excellent show. Mina, Dan, you are absolutely correct. And Carrie Coon in that show, she was perfect.
Never nominated, right? For an Emmy. Nominated. A tragedy.
What is your guy's go-to Leftovers at home? Do you guys think, like,
I know he was going to do this, and save it for just a second, all right? What is your go-to Leftover is a worthy conversation, but I knew you were going to take it somewhere else, not because you're fat, but because I don't think anyone on this show would like The Leftovers, even as Mina Kimes is saying that it's the best show she's seen on television in 10 years. And I think it's a work of art as well. But I don't believe that Billy would like that show. I don't believe that Tony would like that show. And I don't believe that Chris would like that show. And there are probably reasons that you guys have never watched it, correct?
I've actually seen the first season, and I was like, I enjoyed it. I didn't love it, but I was just like, it's a little heavy for me. I like lighter stuff.
Pardon me for not watching The Leftovers, Daniel.
What was that?
Your old English guy? Like, what is that? Is that a guy who just came out of a castle library in England? What was that?
It's someone who's highbrow with class, unlike the rest of you ruffians.
All right, I like this character. Why?
It's very limited, Dan.
That's a pretty good accent.
But I like him as a highfalutin guy who comes over here to tell us that The Leftovers is not art, because it is art. And, man, Mina, I think we're in the minority opinion on this. I think if we throw this out to this audience, they are not going to like The Leftovers.
What? I think that's disrespectful to your audience. The problem with The Leftovers, and Chris, to give you some credit, the first season is a bit of a slog at times. It's real heavy. It's beautiful and incredible, and the performances are amazing. I mean, it's a show about grief. That's a tough sell. It's a show about grief. Unless you're a professional. Right, he's a grief eater.
Perfect Dan show.
He ate that show up, man.
I ate up The Leftovers.
Cha-ching! Time for some ads.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they set me up for that one. Chris, go ahead and put it on the poll. Gather together some favorite leftovers here so we can end the show on some of the best things. Chinese food, got to be.
Oh, I think Indian.
Really? Better than... Put it on the poll, Guillermo, at Lebitard Show. Better leftovers, Chinese food or Indian food?
Or pizza.
Pizza?